This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Earlier this month, North Carolina experienced the largest crackdown on street gangs in its history. Although four other states were part of an early morning roundup of alleged gang members, the epicenter was our state and this city. We talk about the prevalence of gangs and about this renewed effort to minimize their impact in just a moment. First, after just a few weeks of study by parents and school board members, the board met last night to vote on the controversial student assignment plan. WFAE's Lisa Wharf and Gwendolyn Glenn, I believe, were both there, and they've both been up all night. They join us now to fill us in on what happened. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
This was, and I was trying to follow this both on your blogs and on the Charlotte Observer last night, and this just kept going and going and going. It was a long, contentious meeting.
That's a good way to describe it. It went until about 8 a.m. Excuse me, 1 a.m. You can tell I've been asleep. But it went until about 1 a.m., and it was very contentious. You had people on both sides. Some said they liked it. Some said they didn't. And they spoke very passionately about what they thought about this plan. Some said it didn't go far enough, that it wasn't bold enough. And you even had attempts at the very beginning when the board part of the meeting started where there was a motion to not vote on the plan at all. And you had Mary McCray, who is the chair of CMS board. She said that they spent more time on, say, for instance, the first phase of this where they looked at magnet schools and the student assignment plan for that. And she said, we spent four times more on that, and this affects more students. That motion did fail, but you did have board members at times sniping at each other and having to be reined in.
That vote to delay was defeated 5-4. What was the split?
It was along racial lines, and you had Mary said also that she felt like to do nothing is better than to do the wrong thing, and she had some issues as did the other African-American board members about many aspects of
this. Because we talked to her on this program yesterday, Mary McCray, who's the chair of the school board, and she didn't seem to be terribly opposed to the plan, and yet she felt that it wasn't ready to vote on last night. And as you say, she said it was better to do nothing than to do something that was bad.
And she voted, I believe she approved most parts of the plan. There were a few parts that she did oppose. But there was certainly this feeling that, okay, it's been a month since they actually presented the boundary proposals and everything, and that it was just really fast. And then you had this past week where they threw another school into the mix as far as redrawing boundary lines for both Alexander Graham Middle School and Sedgefield Middle School. So then you had parents there coming up and saying, I didn't know about this until Monday.
Yeah, and they had 48 hours to think about it before the vote. So how did the board explain that they've given enough time to consideration on that change?
Well, they said they'd been going through all the public input and that they had evaluated it all. And Eric Davis really held this up, particularly with Alexander Graham Middle School redrawing those boundaries as taking community input and making it a better plan, he said. Of course, there were several parents who would be shifting middle schools that, you know, didn't think it was a better plan, but it did create more socioeconomic balance between two middle schools.
The board has been talking about this in broad strokes for several years, and then the plan came out about, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago that Ann Clark, the superintendent, devised. And so there's been a lot of input from parents and a lot of opportunities for input. And evidently, according to yesterday's program in which we had Ann Clark and Eric Davis, who's District 5 school board representative, and Mary McCray on the program, they did listen and they did make changes. And Ann Clark said she was happier with the plan she presented last night with the changes included than she was with her own original plan. And Eric Davis addressed several times on this program the reason why delaying a vote would be a bad thing. Among them, the bonds. If you delay the vote, the bonds may not pass. And Mary McCray said something I've never heard a school board person say last night. She said, I would rather the bonds fail if the passage depends on a gamble.
Yeah, she said that last night, too.
And She did, and she said, I'd rather the bonds fail if the board had a plan that doesn't express equity across all lines. And that's when she said that about doing nothing is better than doing the wrong thing.
So one of the critics – I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say, and you had people there last night with signs saying vote no to the bonds if you don't delay. And some people said that if you don't make the changes that we have asked you to make, that we will vote no on the bond deal.
One of the goals of this plan was to break up pockets of extreme poverty. And I think there's been a lot of criticism about from people saying that it doesn't achieve that. Was that discussed as part of this broad discussion last night as they voted on each of these issues?
They did talk about it, where they said, no, we have not achieved that in many cases, and pointed out some schools where they said, okay, we're making these shifts and we're shifting students around and nothing has been achieved. And that was supposed to be one of the major goals that we looked at to break up these concentrations of poverty. And that didn't happen in a lot of the schools. It did happen with, Sedgefield's numbers?
Yeah. I mean, there were areas where you did see those pockets, with Sedgefield and Dilworth Elementaries, that pairing. As well as Billingsville and Cotswold, that did do that. But as Thelma Byers-Bailey pointed out, too, I mean, there were a lot of schools, a lot of high poverty schools that were left untouched. That bothered her and several other board members.
And we've talked about that, some of them. The Reed Park in the Westerly Hills, they'll still be 99% low social economic status. And Ranson, once they get students from Bruns, they will get even more low-income students as opposed to what they had before.
So there's definitely tension on the board between people who think, the plan could have been bolder, and then people who say, well, it's a good first start. We're working against a lot of stuff.
So the two big points of contention as this discussion has gone on for the past several weeks were the pairings of those schools, Billingsville and Cotswold, Sedgefield and Dilworth and a few others. And then, of course, what they're going to do with some magnets and making some magnet schools partial magnets, because evidently CMS does not have a great history with success with turning magnets into partial magnets. They were all approved last night, correct? So did they come to any conclusions about whether or not these partial magnets are successful?
Well, the parents still talked against them and said that Moorhead STEM, they said they did not want to be partial. And you had parents from other schools saying the same thing. You had some board members who said that why break up these when they are successful, and said that one of our goals is to expand on successful programs, and said, well, if we're not going to do that, then we might as well just take that out as a goal. Because to make these partial, they pointed to Harding and said Harding was a full magnet years ago, and now it's a partial magnet. It was successful as a full magnet. It's struggling as a partial magnet.
Yeah, and CMS Superintendent Ann Clark said to counter that we are expanding these programs and that we may be breaking up the full magnet into a partial, but we're adding magnet seats and we're trying to make that magnet spread throughout the whole school so that it benefits magnet students and neighborhood students alike.
During the recession, there were changes made to the schools for monetary reasons, and the West Side felt slighted by this and hurt by this. And in fact, some successful school is no longer successful, they say, as a result of what they did during that. And does that represent what the board split was pretty much throughout this whole thing?
Well, that's what they talked about, saying that they felt that the African-American community and low-poverty neighborhoods are bearing the brunt of these changes, that there are being tweaks made in some of the outskirts, but in terms of those particular neighborhoods, that they're bearing the brunt, and they think that it's not equitable, those who were opposed to some of this.
And that's where you saw one of the closest votes with modifications with some of the K through 8 schools. And it's a intriguing situation because you have some K through 8 schools, parents there who like it now, like Reed Park, and they are supposed to be – they will be broken up into elementary schools. But of course, that move was made in 2011 to save money, and many parents opposed it at that time.
But were similar things heard last night from people like the parents of Eastover students and parents of Myers Park High School students? Were similar things heard by them or from them last night?
They were certainly. You know, there were concerns about going to Sedgefield Middle for sure. And
what? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So Sedgefield Middle right now is a pretty struggling school, high poverty struggling
right.
school. And so how it would change is that, you know, there would be AG and Sedgefield Middle would have about a third low-income students next year and maybe about 50% high income.
What did parents have to say? Because this was a long meeting. This thing went from what, 6:30 till 1 a.m. in the morning?
Yeah, about that.
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock to about 12:30, 12:45.
Did the parents hang in there for the whole time? Or was there a full house the whole time, in other words?
A lot.
Because it was a full house, right?
Well, a lot of them waited until they voted on their particular school, so they did hang around for that. And especially one thing, University Park, that's another one that was approved to be a partial magnet. And those parents were very upset and very vocal about that. And they talked about, say, well, in addition to CMS, they said hasn't had this great success with partial magnets, but that if you're saying, okay, somewhere like Bruns Academy, we'll put a partial magnet here, but that doesn't mean people will come there.
Yeah, and here you can hear some of those voices in this.
Your proposal is not bringing diversity to our school, and it is resegregation on the down low.
Did I somehow miss a contract between CMS and Myers Park where we agreed to be repeatedly outsourced to improve CMS schools in other neighborhoods?
Because of this proposal, I am now fully vested in sending my children to CMS, specifically our neighborhood school, Sedgefield Elementary.
It was 48 hours ago that I was informed that the feeder pattern for Eastover to AG Middle School had been changed. And what I have to say to that is, Ann Clark, shame on you. There's no other word for it but shame on you.
Passion would be a good way to characterize all of those comments. And does that bode well for the school system that parents are so passionate about public schools after all these years of public schools taking the brunt of a lot of criticism?
They talked about that, and Ann Clark at the end talked about how they're going to work with the community to bring the community together. And one thing she said during the meeting is that I'm sure the word has gotten back to her that many people think that she is pushing this so hard and fast-tracking it as a legacy because she will be leaving. But she said that this is not about Ann Clark. This is not about my ego. I've listened and we've heard and we've tried to make changes where we could.
And her successor, Clayton Wilcox, who takes over July 1st, is on board with this. He was part of this. He's been kind of ex officio involved in all the discussions.
And he was there last night, too.
I have 30 seconds. What has this plan achieved?
That's yet to be seen, I would guess, at this point, you know, to see how it all pans out and how it's implemented. That's
right.
What some people say is how you implement it is the important thing.
And it is a plan that starts to take socioeconomic status in the picture.
And it goes into effect not next fall, but the fall after next in 2018. Gwendolyn Glenn and Lisa Ward from WFAE News, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Coming back, we're talking about another kind of gang in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and DHG, a public accounting firm based in Charlotte. The people of DHG work to combine global assurance, tax, and advisory resources with a commitment to help you and your business succeed. And the Fresh Market, celebrating the Memorial Day weekend with meats and seafood, prepared sides, and more for the holiday weekend, online at thefreshmarket.com. On tomorrow's local news roundup, the school board makes decisions, as we all know, on the pupil assignment plan, even as a special report reveals that talented low-income students are often overlooked in public schools throughout the state. The Supreme Court strikes down North Carolina's 1st and 2nd District congressional boundaries, saying race played too big a role. The Black Political Caucus endorses Vi Lyles for mayor, and the NBA All-Star Game will return. details on those stories and more tomorrow with our roundtable of reporters on the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks at 9.
I'm Jessica Yellen. Coming up on the next On Point, from climate change to healthcare reform and sanctuary cities, California's taking center stage in the resistance to President Trump. Are they California dreaming? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point coming up at 10 right after Charlotte Talks. Here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. A few weeks ago, law enforcement rounded up alleged gang members in four states. 600 law enforcement officers from more than a dozen agencies were involved in this enormous effort, which resulted, and the numbers keep changing in my head, so I hope I'm right about this, resulted in 50 arrests, half in Charlotte. Another 14 came from Cleveland County, where Shelby has become a surprisingly strong outpost for gang activity, according to authorities. It was the largest sweep of gangs in North Carolina history. 83 people believed to be part of a wing of the United Blood Nation gang, known as Nine Tray Gangsters, were named in federal indictments, which alleged everything from murder to robbery and revealed a surprising breadth of influence. The fact that gangs seem to have permeated even some of our more rural areas may come as a shock. So we're going to talk about the ubiquity of gangs for the rest of the hour and about new tools being provided to law enforcement under the Trump administration to arrest criminals. With us from NPR in Washington is Jill Westmoreland Rose. She is U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Dr. Shannon Reed is Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UNC Charlotte. Good morning to
Good
you.
Morning.
And Detective Michael Nguyen is with us. He is a gang prevention officer with Charlotte Mecklenburg PD. Thank you for being here, too.
Good morning.
Jill, what led to this roundup here at this moment in time?
Well, it's been a long investigation, several years, obviously starting with localized crimes, localized activity, and, of course, building on those crimes, we were able to put together this broad indictment spanning many states, some incarcerated, obviously a lot on the streets. And so it's been a long, long investigation. But it was really prompted by violent crime on the streets. Mm.
How many different law enforcement agencies were actually involved in either the investigation or the roundup?
There were six primary partners in the investigation, led by the FBI and, of course, our partners at CMPD and Cleveland County Sheriff, Shelby Police, Gaston County Police, Department of Public Safety in North Carolina. So it really was a concerted effort at all state and local and federal levels.
The Trump administration, from the president on the campaign trail, and Jeff Sessions, who is the attorney general, have both talked about cracking down on crime. And I believe you told WBTV that under the Trump administration, you have more tools to fight crime. For instance...
Well, what we're able to do now is to apply the laws that were already on the books. The Sessions memo reversed the Holder memo for Department of Justice employees. Under the Holder memo, we were prohibited from charging certain offenses, prohibited from using firearms offenses in certain cases or mandatory drug minimums. And that was removed, and we've gone back to the prior practices of the history of the Department of Justice.
In your
mind, with the Sessions memo.
In your mind, is that a good thing?
It's a good thing to have – well, first of all, it's a good thing to follow the law. I mean, these are laws that Congress passed in order for us to use them as tools in fighting crime at all levels. And, of course, as you heard, this particular case involves not only violent crime but white-collar crimes and other sophisticated methods. So using the full panoply of the laws that we have, I think, first of all, it's what we should do. And second of all, it does give us more versatility in the way we're able to approach these cases.
I know what answer I would get if I asked a politician this next question, but you're not a politician, so I'm curious as to what answer I'm going to get. Violent crime increased in many of the nation's largest cities in 2016 for the second year in a row, and that means those cities saw jumps in homicide and robbery and aggravated assault. Are you saying that the rise was due to a more lenient approach during the Obama administration?
You know, I don't know. I do know violent crime has jumped in our district. I do know we get calls from community members asking for help. Certainly letting out a lot of violent criminals with the commutations. Those people have already gotten out and started committing other crimes. And the ability not to charge cases that we previously would have certainly has affected it. But it's a little bit outside of my realm of knowledge to go so far as to speculate, and I'm not big on speculating. I want to deal with the facts. And what I do know is that we have had a rise in violent crime here, and we certainly have had a rise and an outcry from communities looking for help.
How much of the rise in violent crime is due to gang activity?
That's hard to say, too. Certainly, we saw a tremendous amount of violent crime in this particular case. We have seen it across the board, but this was certainly more organized than most.
Would you have been able to hand down or hand up the indictments that you came up with, these 83 indictments, under the Obama administration's Department of Justice? Is it only possible to do it now under the new approach by the Trump administration?
I wouldn't say that. I would say that we have a greater breadth of charges now, but we did racketeering charges under the Obama administration and did them very successfully.
So let's go back to this actual roundup. Let's put this into perspective. I've read several stories on this, and sometimes the number changes, so I'd like to know exactly how many arrests were made because I'm not sure. But what I have here is it led to 50 arrests in Charlotte and 83 indictments. Is that accurate?
There were 83 defendants indicted in this bill of indictment. 27 were in state custody on other charges at the time that we began the roundup. So the rest were located on the streets of Charlotte, Cleveland County, and then elsewhere in the state of North Carolina and Virginia.
So how does that compare to the three other states that were involved in this roundup? Are we I describe this as being the epicenter of all this. Are we, in fact, the epicenter of all this?
We are.
Wow.
In this particular case, yes. Now, it depends on how you want to define epicenter. Certainly, we indicted the leaders who were in custody in the New York Department of Corrections, who were running and approving certain gang activities here in North Carolina and beyond. Mm. But part of this gang's ability to be effective in their community, I should say, is their ability to move frequently, the ability to influence actions elsewhere. That's part of what they want to do. They want to grow. They want to exert authority. They want to enhance the reputation of the gang.
Well, we've talked about gangs on this program many times in the past, but it's still in my head. When you think of gangs, you think of Los Angeles, you think of maybe New York, but certainly L.A. You don't think of Charlotte, and you absolutely don't think of Shelby or Concord, and we've proven that that is not the case. Michael, Michael Wynn is with us. He is a gang prevention officer with CMPD. How would you characterize these 50 arrests? It doesn't sound all that big, but then it sounds enormous when you consider the city size. Is it?
Well, Mike, I've been with the CMPD for 20 years, and prior to I got a new assignment the last 2 months as a gang prevention, but before that, for the last 9 years, I was with the gang unit. I've done plenty of presentation, and throughout the years, being 20 years, is Charlotte like big city? No, in my mind, because we don't have gangs where it's territorial in an aspect. In other words, if somebody from Central Avenue walk over to the plaza, they get them, catch them, they're going to shoot them or whatever. We don't have that aspect. That's why. But we do have a small amount of that here. But we don't have it, like you just said, L.A., Houston, Chicago, that nature.
Right.
Right? So I don't want to put out the fear that we have this big old gang in Charlotte. We need to be concerned. But if you look at the crime-wise, what gangs commit, who they commit upon, right? Each other, violent crime over predominantly money, drugs, et cetera.
And it's let me be clear about this. What you're saying is that primarily gang activity here affects gangs. They aren't necessarily targeting people outside the gang, but is that true? Because a lot of this involves robbery.
Exactly right. That's robbery. But who are they robbing, right? Sometimes they do go after the community, but most of the time they go after each other. Now, we haven't even touched the international community.
Right.
There's a lot of that's going on that we don't have it because the community trust within the police, or are we willing to report, et cetera, right? So
in other words, within the Latino community, within the Asian community, they are maybe not liable to report in problems with gang activity because they don't trust the police.
Not just trust, but the fear of retaliation.
From the gangs.
Exactly right. And
for being a snitch.
Right. But not only that, it's the language, judicial system. You got all the whole things. So that's what we're trying to do is the education of the community. Mm-hmm. We got a lot of large population of refugees here also.
And Jill, you have said that gang activity, gangs are absolutely a problem here. You said also that it is younger and much more violent, these gangs, than previous generations. How so?
They're recruiting younger, and obviously in immigrant communities, it's a sense of belonging. Of course, that is true across many gang communities, that it really is a sense of belonging. But they are recruiting younger. They want to avert some of the laws or avoid some of the laws by getting around the age minimums in federal court. It's 18 years and above as an adult in federal court. And so they have a lot of reasons for doing it early and hopefully to avoid detection.
How young is young?
Middle schoolers.
What? Really?
Yes.
And what kinds of gang activity or crimes are they involved in?
Well, they're runners in open-air drug markets. They, too, can commit crimes. They can participate in robberies. They can carry weapons. They can prey on the neighborhood. There's any number of things, and they're willing to do it because they want the admiration of others.
Dr. Shannon Reed is a criminologist. She's an assistant professor of criminal justice and criminology at UNC Charlotte, and she is here. You've studied gangs extensively. Explain the attraction to a middle schooler of being in a gang.
Yes, and that's an important question because we actually see gang membership peak around 13 to 15 years old. And a lot of that comes from, it's not so much that it's an attraction to gangs, but a lack of other opportunities. And so if you have a youth who is struggling in school, having come from a dangerous community, potentially a violent home, the gangs offer them, at least on the surface, a sense of control over their lives, a sense of economy. And unfortunately, they learn fairly quickly that despite their desire for protection and safety and money, the gang doesn't really offer that. They're going to be victimized more once they're in the gang, and they're going to be victimizing more people in the gang.
And once you're in, it's difficult to get out?
No, actually, it's
really
not difficult to get out. The average youth is in the gang for about a year, and a lot of them leave simply. They fade away. It's sort of a
because they discover it's not all it's cracked up to be. It doesn't operate the way it appears. It doesn't benefit you the way it
absolutely
appears.
Yes. It's a good visual to see people on the street having money, having nice cars, having respect. But the reality is, it's dangerous. You're probably going to end up in prison or jail. You're getting stopped by law enforcement, and so it loses its appeal, and they stop hanging out as much. And they try as best they can to sort of slowly move away. And so, you know, it's not a straightforward process because, of course, unless you can move from that community, you are going to see these people at school and in your neighborhood.
And this may not be an answerable question because it's probably the motives are probably as numerous as there are people in gangs. But what's the motivation? Is it money? Is it drugs? Is it sex trafficking? What is it?
For them to join?
To join, to be involved, and the economic engine of the gang itself.
Yeah. I mean, I think most youth, when I talk to them, and I've talked to a lot of youth who are incarcerated in California's Division of Juvenile Justice, most of them either talk about feelings of wanting to belong and feelings of protection. If you're walking to school every day and you're afraid, the gang offers you a way to feel less afraid and to have control over the violence in your life. If you know you're going to get victimized, having some sort of sense of, yeah, I'm going to get victimized, but I brought it on myself. Yeah. You know, I know who's attacking me versus it being a stranger. And money, right? You're not going to tell a 13, 14-year-old that money is not appealing. It is.
Right. How many different gangs operate in the Charlotte area or the area that was involved in this roundup, which included Concord and Shelby and other areas? How many different gangs?
Well, To follow up, first of all, let me follow up what Shannon and Jill were saying earlier about, because I do a presentation too. The last 2 months, I've done over 6 different middle school, predominantly 8th graders, okay. over 1,200 kids.
Okay.
And I teach them gangs, just like what Shannon was saying, talking about how to get in gangs, why do they get in gang, and the basically the consequence of being a gang. But to answer your question, Mike, about the gang here in Charlotte, we have what I consider a hybrid gang. What Jill was talking about is more of a structured gang, a traditional gang. Now, then you have the modern gang, which is the hybrid, where kids no longer get beat in doing these crimes to get in this gang, but 4 or 5 kids get involved in a situation where they basically throwing up a common sign or wearing the same shirt or whatever. But they go out and they commit crimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for benefit of their gangs. In their mind, they don't think they're a gang. They could represent rap group. They could represent anything. In their mind, when they get caught there, and I go talk to mom and dad, your son's in gangs. They have no idea that they themselves in a gang. But by definition itself, yeah. they're involved in criminal activities.
Wow. Why don't they know? Is it hidden from them, or is it just ignorance of the law? Is it ignorance of the other activities going on within the gang?
Well, you got to look at traditional gangs. In order for you to be in my gang,
mm-hmm.
right, I have to trust you. You
right.
have to commit these crimes, right? You have to basically make sure that you can be part of this group, get beat in, et cetera, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But now these kids, they're smart. I don't want to get beat in. I don't do crime, but I want to hang out with you
yeah.
so we can do all together. There's no structure. There's no leadership. So that's where the danger come in.
It probably shocked, Jill, a lot of people when they learned that many of the gang members rounded up were from places like Shelby and Concord, not just Charlotte. The FBI, Cleveland County Sheriff's Office, the Shelby Police Department, other agencies arrested 26 Cleveland County gang members. Why would these gangs be in smaller towns, Jill Westmoreland? Rose.
Well, they go there because it's an area where they want to expand their efforts. They want to grow the gang. They get a lot of credit for expanding their territories. They move into these areas and take over. They have prime areas where they can victimize people. Other gangs aren't already in the area, although territory is something, at least here in this area, that's not particularly significant to the gang, but certainly expansion is. And getting the more members you have, the more dues you get.
Explain that concept. I didn't know that gang members paid dues, but they pay dues, and a lot of that money goes to people incarcerated in New York State prisons or federal prisons in New York.
Right. And I'm talking about larger organized gangs, maybe not these local yeah. rap label and small neighborhood gangs. But with the UBN, and of course in my experience with the MS as well, dues are a very important part. They help sustain the gang. They help buy burner phones that they can use to communicate with one another, hopefully to avoid law enforcement detection. And of course, they help with bond or bail for members who are incarcerated. And then, of course, in this particular case, we were able to show through the organization that they were paying tribute dues to the leaders that were housed in the New York Department of Corrections. And so there were some huge contrary accounts of these leaders. And, of course, we were able to show through our investigation members in this area going to meet with those leaders, getting permission to carry out criminal activity here, and, of course, putting money in their commissary.
We're going to talk more about that when we come back, and we'll also talk about how some gang members, a little bit more about how some gang members may not realize they're in a gang. Okay. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members in Carolina Tree Care, providing residential and commercial general tree care, specializing in tree health care services. Carolina Tree Care's passion is to maintain and care for the canopy of the Carolinas. Information at carolinatreecare.com. And Novant Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, providing patients with customized care and treatment plans designed to help them regain mobility to live life with a full range of motion. More at novanthealth.org/motion. Coming up at 10 on Point, Jessica Yellen will be in as guest host for a conversation about California and the state's resistance to several issues in the Trump administration, from climate change to health care reform and sanctuary cities. California has taken center stage in a resistance to President Trump. Are they California dreaming? That's coming up at 10, 20 minutes from now on 90.7 WFAE. And we are coming right back with more talk about gangs.
Thanks to LeBron James' career path with the Cleveland Cavaliers, a pair of economists tried to quantify how his presence on the team affects the city's restaurants and bars.
You can see how they started throwing liquor all over the place. Sign of success.
I guess so.
The LeBron James Effect this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a recent roundup of gangs and gang members with the passing up of 83 indictments in the last several weeks here in the Charlotte area and in three other states as well, with Jill Westmoreland Rose, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. Michael Nguyen is a gang prevention officer and detective at CMPD, and Dr. Shannon Reed, an assistant professor of criminal justice and criminology at UNC Charlotte, who is chafing at the bit to take issue with some of the things that have been said, which you say are myths that have been debunked.
Yes.
What are you talking about?
Yes, and this is not in any sort of way meant to, you know, put aside what the law enforcement community has been working on with this particular case. But a lot of times when these cases come out, what we hear is a lot of these myths about gang members and their gangs that have just sort of not been well held up in the research.
Meaning?
So, for example,
there's
always a dialogue around that gangs are recruiting youth, especially younger youth, that they're more violent. And no, we have never hit a point of violence the way we hit in the early to mid-90s. And the idea that these kids are younger, right? The research from the 30s, 40s, 50s has shown this peak age range of about 13 to 15, and that stayed pretty consistent over these years. And so I guess it just always makes me nervous when I hear this rhetoric repeated about, you know, they're purposely going to small towns and recruiting and setting up shop, because again, very rarely is gang migration the start or really the impetus to a growth in a gang problem in a city.
So let me pick up on something that Detective Nguyen said a second ago, that some of these kids don't necessarily think of themselves as being in a gang, and in fact probably aren't in the gang, but they do like to hang out with these attractive gang members who have money to flash around, et cetera, et cetera. And if I understand you and your research, Dr. Reed, correctly, mm-hmm. it says that not everyone who is rounded up may think of themselves as a gang member. So that provides a problem, it would seem to me, for law enforcement, because if you think you're not in a gang, how are they identifying you as a member of a gang?
Well, people get identified, and Detective Wayne can talk about this too, in a number of ways. So when we think about how youth end up in gang databases, both at the local level and the state level, what happens is you usually have to hit one or three, you know, different key points. So either a known informant labels you as a gang member, you get arrested with known gang members, you have tattoos, or you throw hand signals which are associated with the gang, which could be your home's territory, your street name, right? And so even if you never self-identify, or even if you do self-identify, you're going to be in this gang database.
But yeah, but if you don't think of yourself as being in a gang, mm-hmm. but you are hanging around mm-hmm. with these guys, mm-hmm. aren't you in the gang?
Well, it's called guilt by association, Mike. The bottom line is this. Based on the definition alone, three or more people, mm-hmm. right, having common signs and symbols, right, committing criminal activity, ongoing activity, to basically for that group, right? So if we don't go out there and say, "Oh, you three or four people, you must be a gang because you're out here breaking the cars." No, we don't normally go out there and identify that way. Mm. However, when you get to the gang radar, is when you start shooting back and forth. Right. That's when we come in and say, "Oh, this group is this. They claim themselves as a rap label, and they have a problem with the other guy on the west side who happened to be this group, and they're fighting back and forth because somebody owed them some money over drug deals or whatever it is." Right. So now the gang detective has to come in and look at that.
So when we talk about the UBN, which is what, the United Blood Nation,
correct.
And the Crips, and the there was another one, Jill, that you mentioned. MS-13, yes. When there are affiliates of those gangs in Charlotte or the Charlotte area or North Carolina, are they self-identified affiliates, or would the United Blood Nation hierarchy see them as bona fide members of their gang?
Well, generally, people aren't allowed to be, at least what we've seen here, are not allowed to just hang around with gang members without doing something on behalf of the gang. Now, there is something known as an associate, but we don't prosecute people as guilty by association. First of all, that'd be unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. What we do is look at the facts and the evidence and the overt acts that they're committing in furtherance of the gang activity. And so that's why the racketeering statutes are so effective. And I'll give you an example of an associate, someone who didn't claim to be a bona fide member of the UBN, but who carried out significant overt acts on behalf of them, and that was Breonna Johnson. You might recall the mattress store robbery and the Londons who were murdered, who were witnesses to that robbery. Breonna Johnson drove her boyfriend, who was a bona fide member, to kill the Londons. She claimed she was an associate, but in doing so, committed acts on behalf of the gang,
right,
and was in part of the planning of this murder. So you don't necessarily have to be a quote-unquote bona fide member to be able to carry out acts on behalf of the gang. But if you're going to associate with them, there is some expectation that you're going to carry out those acts. And I do want to follow up on something else. You know, you go to the people of Shelby and Cleveland County, they would beg to differ with the analysis by Dr. Reed, because they would say those people moved in there intentionally and that they were, in fact, recruiting, that they would say to them, you know, don't you want to make some money? Hey, I'll allow you to be part of this. I mean, they really did look for vulnerable young people to be part of this gang, and they saw it as a fertile area to expand their territory.
One of the surprising things that came out of all of this is that a lot of this gang activity is directed by inmates in the New York prison system. First of all, why, Jill? And second, how is that possible?
Look, as we said, these gangs are often about respect and about maintaining and enhancing their reputation and growing their numbers. If they grow their numbers, they're what? They're getting more dues. They're getting more dues. They're getting more tribute payments. So they
were
directed.
But you're a guy stuck in prison in New York State someplace,
right?
And I'm a 20-year-old guy in Charlotte, North Carolina. Why do I care about paying tribute to this dude in prison?
Because he's your leader.
But he's locked up. He ain't going anywhere.
He's not going anywhere, but he still has power. He has thousands of soldiers on the street.
Why does he have power? Why does somebody locked up in prison have power? What's that all about?
You know, it's just part of the philosophy. It's part of the belief. It's part of the myth. You know, it's part of what makes this an enterprise and an organization. Every organization has to have a leader, and they want to know that they are not just varied people committing random acts of violence, that they are part of a bigger picture. They are part of something bigger. And there's this tribute to these original gangsters who really do have a say in making sure that the rules are followed, making sure that this organization is a bona fide organization, and that it continues to expand and grow. It's all about power. It's all about reputation. Mm. And so, you know, it's an interesting dynamic, but at the end of the day, we had people traveling up there to New York to get permission to carry out certain acts. They couldn't kill somebody unless it was green-lighted and approved by leadership. And so these rank and structure is what makes this gang such a potent organization.
Dr. Reed.
I just wanted to say one quick thing about the age range of these youth and organization. When we talk about sort of, like you're saying, what's my incentive to pay these dues and do these different activities, I think most people who've ever worked with 13 to 15-year-olds know that they are not really always very capable of organized movement on the street, following orders. And so I just want to be clear that while there is some organization to some gangs, most youth are involved in these very sort of low-level, very disorganized, that is the majority of gangs that are reported across the entire United States, L.A. included, Chicago included, because youth are youth, right? Mm. They are not really capable of sort of non, if you want to run a corporation, you don't want youth who are on the streets being expressively violent, getting into trouble, because that's how you get arrested. That's how you get police on you. And so I just want to be clear that there's sometimes this disconnect between being organized and structured in a corporation and the reality of what it means to be a 13, 14-year-old gang member.
Michael.
But the danger of that, when you have two wannabe gang member, right, shooting at each other, we don't have a wannabe homicide because these are youth that basically don't think. Mm-hmm. That's the reason why it's very important for us to reach out to the middle eighth grader before they go to ninth grader, because that instant gratification, I want it now, and I understand the consequences. Mm-hmm. That's the danger we're talking about. Now, the organized guys, the OG, they know what's going on. Of course, they're not going to, like Shannon said, they're not going to send out a 13-year-old kid to do this stuff. They didn't get the heat on them. It's very organized in some aspect.
It's clear the UBN is not a bunch of children.
Right.
They're not
right.
a group of
yeah.
children.
No, I'm not saying
this is an
that.
Organization.
Okay. You Jill, and Michael, you just used OG again, and you called them
original gangster.
Original gangster.
The leader. Yeah.
So let's talk about that for just a second, because that's a term I'd never heard before yesterday. Original gangster. These are the guys who are locked up, and they're the OG. They're the head of the organization. Is that correct?
That's true. They're called the Godfathers as well. They're the ultimate and supreme leader of any particular group. And look, with the UBN, you've got a huge range of sets. You have the Valentines, you have, you know, your G Shine, you have the Nine Tray Gangsters. There are all these different sets that who each have a Godfather.
But. Nobody on the panel today is a psychologist or a psychiatrist, so maybe this is also an unanswerable question. We do have a criminologist here. We do have a detective, and we have the U.S. attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. If you're a part of the old original gang and you're in prison for your gang activity and you're going to be there for years, mm-hmm. why isn't that a deterrent? Why is that seen as somebody to pay tribute to?
If you look at it, the traditional gang, and that's from Hispanic to Asian to African American, these guys have people out there that's underneath them. They're underneath them that work for them.
Yeah, I know. But
because look, the reason why he's in there because he did something major.
Yeah.
He earned it. Therefore, he got the power still within him.
Okay. The United Blood Nation, or the Godfathers, or the original gang members of that organization. I'm told that the gang is about 44,000 members strong, and well, you're saying no.
No, I would disagree with that.
Okay. And allegedly in Charlotte, they are responsible for a string of seemingly unrelated crimes, including multiple murders, racketeering, firearms trafficking, robbery, and bank fraud. And although they have possibly been involved in the heroin trade, as well as cocaine and narcotics, most recently they moved into white-collar crime like credit card fraud and identity theft. What does that tell us about these gangs or this kind of gang activity, Jill Westmoreland Rose?
They certainly have become more sophisticated and diversified in their crimes. Look, again, it's about making money not only for the members of the gang, but their ability to show their wealth, to show their power, to be feared and respected. And, of course, you know, to be able to pay tribute to those who need their help, to look after their fellow members who are in jail, who need bond money. As I said, to buy tools or implements, whether it's weapons or phones or anything else, to further their activity. You know, the UBN is very different than the West Coast Bloods. They're an offshoot of the West Coast Bloods from the 80s, but they're very, very different. And because they have so many sets, you know, they're pretty broad and expansive. I don't think the 44,000 is an off number, particularly when you talk to law enforcement all over the East Coast and what they're dealing with from this organized group.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very, very different than the West Coast Bloods, and I think that's a distinction that needs to be clear.
Well, Dr. Reed, why do you think the 44,000 number is wrong, and do you think it's wrong on the high side?
I think it's wrong on the sense that even in the indictment it says that all these blood groups, these sets, are related to each other, and that's a fallacy. Most blood groups have no relation to each other and will fight with each other.
Right.
The sort of people talk about the blood versus Crips, but it's neighborhood versus neighborhood.
So we have a disagreement over some of the facts that have been shared here. You've called them, some of them, myths. We have a disagreement over the number of people involved in gangs. We have a disagreement probably on the connected nature of some of these members of gangs to the actual big gangs themselves. How would you characterize, Dr. Reed, the gang problem in this region or throughout the country? Are we making a mountain out of a molehill in your mind?
I don't think we're making a mountain out of a molehill. I think we're focusing on the wrong part of the problem. I think, and I think Detective Nguyen would agree with some of this, is that when we're hitting this level of sort of upper-level people, that's too late. We need to be back dealing with the younger kids, providing them opportunities and options to avoid gang life.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions says that gangs represent one of the gravest threats to American safety. Do you agree with that, Dr. Reed?
No.
Do you agree with that, Michael?
I don't. I mean, it's just a small amount, but I don't want to create fear. You know, that's the whole
Jill
thing.
Jill Westmoreland Rose, where do you come down on this?
I deal with the communities and the people that are victims of this crime. You know, certainly to the London family, they're a grave risk. Certainly to the community, the people that are calling us and say, get rid of the open-air drug markets, get rid of the people that are, you know, threatening my kids as they walk to school, get rid of the shootouts in our neighborhoods. I'm tired of the robbery. So, you know, and if you're a victim of identity theft from one of these groups, you probably fear them a bit. So, look, I'm not into fear-mongering, but I deal with facts. This is not an academic exercise for me. This is facts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dennis emails, am I the only one who sees the connection between the first segment, which was about education on this program and a recent school board move to mix things up again, and the second segment, socioeconomic status is the driving force to joining a gang. Everybody agree with that?
I agree with that.
I agree.
Jill?
Yes.
Okay. Jill Westmoreland Rose is the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina. Dr. Shannon Reed's Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UNC Charlotte. And Michael Nguyen is a gang prevention officer and detective for Charlotte-Mecklenburg PD. Thank you all for the hour.